Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld is testifying before both the Senate and House Armed Services Committees today, insisting there is no alternative but to stay the course in Iraq, and taking some tough questions, including this one from Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy.
There have been a series of gross errors and mistakes. Those are on your watch. Isn't it time for you to resign?
Senator, I've offered my resignation to the president twice. And he's decided that he would prefer that he not accept it. And that's his call.
This as another rash of car bombings in Baghdad today and last night killed some 40 Iraqis and wounded many others. Joining us from Washington, Tom Bowman. He covers military affairs for the Baltimore Sun. Welcome back, Tom. And these were some pretty testy exchanges today.
Yeah, it was a pretty traumatic moment when Senator Kennedy suggested he resign. And of course, Rumsfeld did offer his resignation twice during the Abu Ghraib scandal, but no one else picked up on that. And some of the generals there, General Casey and Myers and Abaze, they were very supportive of Rumsfeld. But clearly it was a pretty sober assessment from all the military leaders about Iraq.
Well, Senator Kennedy and Donald Rumsfeld did have quite a go at it. We just want to listen to a little more of the ending of a very long back and forth between the two.
In baseball, it's three strikes, you're out. What is it for the Secretary of Defense?
Well, that is quite a statement. First, let me say that there isn't a person at this table who agrees with you that we're in a quagmire and that there's no end in sight.
Well, we understand Rumsfeld went on to say it's an insurgency in Iraq, not a guerrilla war. Did he make the distinction?
He said it really comes down to semantics. How do you define it? And it's really beside the point. Clearly, there's a strong insurgency. And I thought it was one point that was made that I thought was quite important is that in the past 6 months, we really haven't seen a decrease in the number of attacks. And that's quite significant.
If anything, perhaps an increase in insurgency
attacks?
No,
they say it stayed about the same. The question is, how do you get your arms around it? How do you decrease it? And what was said at the hearing by the military officers was, well, hopefully with the political process, with the new constitution and the elections in December, that will sort of take the wind out of the sails of the insurgency when people see that there's a functioning government. But we don't know.
Well, in fact, I wanted to ask you about that because Vice President Dick Cheney recently said the insurgency was in its last throes. What did the generals at the hearing say about that? Did they confirm that?
Well, they try to get the General Abaze, who, of course, is the top U.S. commander in the whole region, to weigh in on that issue. He said he didn't want to criticize the vice president, but, you know, he wouldn't use those words, and Rumsfeld pretty much said the same. And what Abaze, again, said was that the insurgency is roughly the same as it was 6 months ago, the number of, and the level of attacks.
Right. Well, Secretary Rumsfeld is also expected to testify before the House Armed Services Committee today. What do you expect to come up there?
Well, that issue, the House hearing will deal with the Iraqi security forces, how many there are, how trained and equipped are they. That'll focus on that effort. Roughly now, 169,000 Iraqi security forces. They hope for 200,000 by the end of the year. But the real question is, how prepared are they? And it, from anecdotal evidence in the field, talking to officers and people in Washington, a very small percentage is actually ready to fight the insurgents on their own. Most of them need some serious American help.
Right. And speaking of troops, U.S. and Iraqi troops, the Washington Post is reporting that the Pentagon has begun working with a marketing firm to create a database of high school students to help the military find potential recruits. You know, more on how the Iraqi troop training is going and when the Pentagon might start pulling out U.S. troops. Was that raised today?
Yeah, they basically, the military leaders say the United States has to stay the course in Iraq. And it was interesting what Rumsfeld said was that if you leave now, you may face an enemy in Iraq worse than the one you just overthrew, meaning Saddam. And there was no one on the panel seriously calling for sharp reductions in U.S. troops. I think they all realized, both Democrats and Republicans, that for the most part, you have to stay there, make sure the Iraqi security forces are up to speed, and then start drawing down.
In the meantime, a leaked CIA report today says that Iraq is probably going to breed a new or more dangerous terrorist anyway, regardless of where the U.S. pulls out now.
That's right. That's another thing that came up at the hearing, is that they're seeing more foreign fighters come into Iraq through Syria. Saudis, North Africans now are starting to come in. So Iraq clearly is a magnet for terrorists.
Tom Bowman, military affairs correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, reporting on today's hearings in Washington. Tom, thanks so much.
Good talking to you.
Well, there is more criticism today of the U.S. treatment of terrorism suspects at Guantanamo Bay. UN human rights experts say they have reliable accounts of detainees being tortured there, and they're demanding a visit to the military base. U.S. government officials say they're reviewing that request, but they deny that the approximately 520 people being held at Guantanamo Bay are being abused. Well, a handful of those detainees are minors, and one, 18-year-old Omar Khadr, has been held at Guantanamo Bay for more than 2 years. And he is a Canadian citizen. Omar Khadr's detention is a huge story in Canada. His family's been called the most despised family in Canada because of their acknowledged Al-Qaeda links. But still, some Canadians are now coming to Omar's defense because of their objections to Gitmo. Joining us on the line from Montreal is Terrence McKenna, a correspondent for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He made a documentary last year on the Khadr family in conjunction with the U.S. program Frontline. Hello, Terrence.
Thanks for having me.
This is a pretty incredible story. It gets right to the heart of the debate over Guantanamo Bay through this one boy. Omar was taken into custody in 2002 at a terrorist training camp in Afghanistan. What was he accused of at the time?
Well, I think he was captured in a firefight with U.S. troops. And, you know, this whole family has a long history with Al-Qaeda, and his father was a friend of Osama bin Laden and a fundraiser for Al-Qaeda.
And this they freely acknowledge?
Yes, they hid it for a long time, and then finally in the documentary you referred to that was on Frontline, the son, Abdulrahman Khadr, came out and admitted it and said, we are an Al-Qaeda family. They had denied it for a long time.
Yeah. And by the way, what did that mean? What else did it mean besides being friends? Where did they live? How did they interact?
These kids grew up in the house beside Osama bin Laden's, in the bin Laden compound in Jalalabad, which is where their father took them to live. They grew up, most of them were born in Canada, but they moved to Afghanistan when they were young and lived in Jalalabad in the compound next to bin Laden.
And Omar, now 18, allegedly followed at least part of Al-Qaeda to Afghanistan, where he allegedly, in that firefight you mentioned, threw a grenade at U.S. soldiers, killing one.
Mm-hmm.
And is now in Guantanamo.
You know, all of the kids had been sent to, all of the male children had been sent to Al-Qaeda training camps, those where you see the famous jungle gyms and monkey bars that you see on the news so often from those camps. So they all had this training, but their father kind of dragged them into this world, and it was all they knew.
And we're going to be speaking with Omar's lawyer in just a moment, but in your opinion, was Omar willingly in Al-Qaeda? Was he...
If it was all he knew from the time he was a small child, you know, what other choice did he have, really? Mm-hmm. And so was he a willing member of Al-Qaeda? Absolutely. He was also, these kids were, I think he might have been 15, his brother was 13 or 14, who was, when the father was finally killed after September 11th in a firefight with Pakistani troops, the father was killed, and an even younger son, Karim, was with him and got a bullet in the spine and was paralyzed from the waist down. But as I said, this was a 14-year-old kid, and it was, theoretically, he was carrying a weapon around that time, and therefore, was he an Al-Qaeda soldier? Well, I guess he was to some degree. Mm. Is this an unrecoverable human life? Probably not, I think most people would say.
Mm. Well, and then there's a sister and a mother living in an apartment in Canada, have not exactly endeared themselves to Canadians.
No, they're unrepentant jihadists and Islamists, and you know they both wear veils, and you can only see their eyes because of the black veils they wear on their faces, and the most outrageous things comes out of their mouth. You know, speaking of the nobility of martyrdom operations, and so these kind of things naturally Canadians are quite upset to hear these. Things coming out of the mouths of Canadian citizens, and there's been various petitions trying to people who want them to be stripped of their citizenship and kicked out of the country or all this kind of thing, which is not very likely to happen.
But still, Omar now is winning supporters in Canada because of their objections to detentions in general at Guantanamo.
Well, I think there's a number of things. There's a lot of Canadians who don't think torturing people in Guantanamo is a great idea, no matter how bad this kid. And then, of course, there's the whole secondary issue of whether he's a minor. You know, so no matter how much revulsion towards the family I think a lot of Canadians feel, they would be thinking that the Canadian government should stand up for Canadian citizens and not see people subjected to torture. And so there's a lot of conflicting emotions in regarding the story, I think.
And a lot of twists and turns. As if all of this weren't enough, one of Omar's brothers, the one who had said that the family was definitely Al-Qaeda, Abdurrahman, also told you that he had a conversion and that he actually was placed in Guantanamo Bay as a CIA agent?
Abdurrahman was always the rebel son. He was always the black sheep of the family. He was always a hellraiser when he lived in Afghanistan. He was always getting into trouble with the Taliban and with the authorities. And so he was very susceptible to the arguments made by the CIA and FBI agents who first dealt with him after he was captured in Afghanistan. And he agreed quite readily to start to act as an agent against Al-Qaeda on behalf of the CIA and the FBI. And that's what he agreed to do. He first started showing people around in Afghanistan and cooperating with the American authorities there. And then he eventually agreed to go into prison and see what information he could find out in prison in Afghanistan, and then they convinced him to go to Guantanamo and act as their agent in the prison population in Guantanamo.
Guantanamo, where his younger brother is.
Right. But I should say at the same time that Abdurrahman was telling us, and he had no particular axe to grind at the time, that he thought most of the people who were in Guantanamo with him had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, and they were kind of innocent bystanders who had been swept up by bounty hunters or for various reasons and ended up there, and that most of the people who were there didn't belong there.
Well, Terrence, two questions for you. Do you believe Abdurrahman? And did he ever tell you if his brother was guilty as charged?
The incident with his brother only took place after Abdurrahman had been caught. So Abdurrahman was in custody, in American custody, at the time his brother, this incident happened with his brother. So he really doesn't know. He suspects that he did. He suspects that he's more or less guilty of what he has been accused of.
Right, throwing a grenade and killing a U.S. soldier in a firefight.
Right.
Yeah, but do you trust him in general?
That's a big question. You know, when I first heard his story, I tended not to believe it, but we tested his story. He gave us a lot of details that we were able to check out through journalistic sources, and then we administered a lie detector test, and he passed it on all the salient details of the story as we presented it.
Terrence McKenna is a correspondent for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He produced a documentary on the Cotter family of Toronto, a story that seems ripe for a fictional version. But when we return, we'll speak with the lawyer for 18-year-old Guantanamo Bay detainee Omar Carter. His story is very real. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation about a Canadian teenager detained at Guantanamo Bay. Now, the U.S. military says Omar Khadr was involved in a deadly firefight with U.S. troops in Afghanistan 3 years ago when Omar was 15. His father had taken Omar and his three brothers to live with Osama bin Laden and train in terrorist camps. In Canada, the Khadrs are reviled, but at the same time, Omar's detention at Guantanamo Bay is raising sympathy. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Professor Richard Wilson. He teaches law at American University. He's part of a legal team voluntarily representing Omar Khadr. And Rick, the family's Canadian lawyers have said the Khadr family is the most despised family in Canada. Would you say that's still true?
Well, I think this, in the case of Omar, this may be a situation of the sins of the father being visited on the son. I think we're focused on our representation of our client, and our client's situation finds him in detention now for nearly 3 years under U.S. custody since he was taken in, captured in Afghanistan, separated from his family.
Well, but I think we just heard a little bit of your legal defense, perhaps, when you said this is the sins of the fathers visited on the son. The father was a higher-up in al-Qaeda, but the son, the U.S. military says, was arrested after throwing a grenade at U.S. soldiers, killing one. His brother has said publicly that they were members of al-Qaeda. Some would say if anyone is to be locked up in Guantanamo Bay, it is Omar Khadr.
Well, the details of his capture and surrender to Guantanamo are accompanied by a good deal of serious mistreatment of him in U.S. custody. And I think our focus has been on that mistreatment. I'm actually not able to talk about the circumstances of his capture because the information surrounding his capture is classified except for the accusation. So we're kind of operating with one, or you could say two, hands tied behind our back.
But well, how does Omar Khadr say he's been mistreated?
Well, I think there's no doubt in my mind that he was tortured in both Bagram Air Force Base and after his arrival at Guantanamo. I think what we need to keep particularly in focus here is that we're talking about a 15-year-old boy, too.
At the time. He's 18 now, but he was 15 at the time he was found in Afghanistan.
That's exactly right.
Well, I just want to hold you there for a second because other U.S. lawyers who are reportedly allowed to speak with him, and I'm not sure if this was you as well, say that Omar told them that he was sexually taunted, shackled in painful positions, and dragged like a human mop over urine-soaked floors.
That's accurate. I think we've made public those parts of his interrogation, that is, his statements to us. As I said, the government has not denied any of those. We've raised those in a pleading we submitted to the judge here in Washington to stop any further interrogation or mistreatment, keeping in mind that he has now been there for 3 years. I think there has to be an end point to interrogations, and I think if we compare this to the context of criminal investigations in the United States, I think there's ample precedent from the Supreme Court that says that holding somebody for interrogation for any longer than 2 weeks is going to make the interrogation suspect.
You mentioned his age. Under international law, Omar Khadr is a minor, but the U.S. military disagrees with that. They define juveniles as under 16. He's now 18. He was, however, 15 when he was in the field in Afghanistan. How much are you going to make his age a part of your legal strategy?
It certainly is very much a part of our thinking. First of all, if we look back to prosecutions for war crimes, if the United States decided to proceed against him, this would be the first prosecution of a child for war crimes. Certainly in an international tribunal, there's never been a prosecution of a child since Nuremberg, and including Nuremberg.
I want to just ask you on a personal level, however much you can share. Are people criticizing you for representing an accused terrorist?
Well, I think the responses have varied. I think a lot of folks believe that what the United States is doing in Guantanamo is wrong, that lawyers who step up and volunteer, because we're not being paid for doing this, we're doing it because of our belief in the right of everyone to due process and to a fair trial and to a day in court. I don't think Omar's had that opportunity yet, and I'd be proud to be able to do that with him.
By the way, as much as you can tell us, what was he like when you visited him? What were his surroundings like?
Well, all of the visits with counsel take place in a separate facility that's right next door to Camp Delta in Guantanamo Bay. When we walk in to talk to him, he is shackled to the floor. His hands are normally shackled, but they're unshackled for his visit so that he can look at documents and talk to us about legal papers. And he's been in, I would say, remarkably good spirits during our visits, given the circumstances of his detention, which have been almost exclusively in solitary confinement for at least the last year or two. And I'd say for an 18-year-old, he's been remarkably composed and I think mature in the circumstances.
Do you just talk about the case? Does he ask you about popular culture or anything outside of that? You know,
he asked about cars. He was interested when we said, what kinds of magazines would you like to see? He said, I want to see the next year's car models. He wanted to see what was happening in that area. His interests are pretty much what every teenager's interests would be.
What a life in, you know, 18 years.
Absolutely.
Rick Wilson is a professor of law at American University. He's part of a legal team representing Guantanamo Bay detainee Omar Khadr. And by the way, in response to our questions about Omar Khadr, the U.S. Justice Department would only say that the U.S. does not condone torture and that the president has directed detainees to be treated, quote, as much as possible in a way that's consistent with the principles of the Geneva Conventions. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. With only a few days to go before its summer recess and perhaps the retirement of Justice William Rehnquist, the Supreme Court ruled this morning that local governments can seize private property in order to make a profit, saying that this act constitutes a public use under the Constitution. That decision, based on a fight between a handful of homeowners and the town of New London, Connecticut, was one of several rulings handed down today. And joining us on the line now, here and now, is Supreme Court analyst Lyle Denniston. He also writes for SCOTUS blog.com. And Lyle, review for us, because the policy of eminent domain, a government seizing private property, is an old one. So what's new today?
Well, what seems to be new, though a close reading of the opinion makes it seem that there isn't a whole lot that the court did differently, is that the court seems to be saying that it will be more willing to allow local governments to engage in urban redevelopment projects, not just to remove blighted areas, but to beautify and, if you will, to expand the appearance and economic attractiveness of a local community, even when the private developer is the one who benefits the most in terms of profits.
Right. You think of eminent domain as, you know, a blighted area being replaced with a superhighway or something. But these were a group of homeowners who had, you know, they said beautiful Victorians. And I understand the space was to make way for an office space. So what is the ruling saying? I mean, that would seem like a private use of the space.
Well, the court said that there is nothing in its prior decisions which said that only the government can undertake projects to improve local communities, but sometimes it's better to allow a private developer to do it. What in my opening comment to you suggested some equivocation here. Mm-hmm. Justice Anthony Kennedy was part of the five-justice majority, but he wrote a separate opinion and suggested that there may be situations in which a city abuses this new power by taking a property away from private homeowners and giving it to a major developer when the public benefit is not as clear as Kennedy and others thought it was in New London, Connecticut.
Lyle Denniston, who's covering the Supreme Court for us, there are a few other decisions. Can you give us one that comes to mind today?
Yes, there is one on the right of a poor accused person to have a lawyer. If a court finds that an individual has pleaded guilty but wants to appeal, the court today declared that the individual has a right to have a court-appointed lawyer for that appeal. It was a fairly narrow decision, and the other four decisions the court announced today were even narrower or more abstruse or technical in nature.
So we're not going to go into them now, but the court did announce that its last day is going to be Monday. We didn't get a ruling yet on the Ten Commandments being displayed in government offices or the case involving downloading Internet music files. That's to come. And in the seconds we have, do you think we'll hear an announcement of Justice Rehnquist's resignation?
Well, I wouldn't think we would hear that immediately on Monday after the court decides. If the Chief Justice is going to retire, I would imagine that he might wait until later in the day at the earliest, but might even wait a day or two. There is some sensation around the court ruling, Robin, that the expectation of his departure is diminishing a little bit, that maybe the indicators are suggesting he might hang on for a time.
Well, there you go. Lyle Denniston covers the Supreme Court for Here and Now. He also writes for SCOTUSblog.com. He's on the scene. And Lyle, thanks very much.
Glad to be with you.
The business practices of Washington, D.C. lobbyist Jack Abramoff and his associate Michael Scanlon are playing out like a tragic comedy on Capitol Hill. The tragedy? Accusations that Abramoff defrauded the Choctaw Indians after charging them $80 million to promote gambling interests. The comedy? Testimony on everything from fake awards for Abramoff to a lifeguard who said Scanlon asked him to run a bogus international organization. Here's Senator John McCain questioning David Grosch of Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, about how that business got started at yesterday's Senate hearing on the Indian Affairs Committee.
And what happened? He approached you in some way?
Phone call.
And said?
Do you want to be head of an international corporation? It's a hard one to turn down.
Dana Milbank of The Washington Post covered the hearings, joins us on the line. Dana, David Grosch was asked to run the American International Center, as he said in his testimony yesterday. Why did Scanlon and Abramoff set up that company? Remind us.
Well, it's part of a huge web of organizations that they set up, but it was arranged as an international think tank, and it received payments that were ultimately from that Choctaw Indian tribe. So it was suggested at the hearing that this is a way of laundering, although they were trying not to use that in a legal sense, but there was a way of filtering money to other groups.
So Grosch set this fake organization up in his beach house, and he seems, after the hearings, to be one of the only good guys.
He was there, and the other director, Grosch, had been a lifeguard, and the other fellow was a yoga instructor. The yoga instructor took the fifth, which I thought was very zen-like. But the two of them had evidently had no business knowledge whatsoever. Grosch says he also works as an excavator and a bartender.
Right, and he felt badly about it.
He sure did. He was a sympathetic fellow. We all wanted to sort of go up and hug him and suggest that maybe he wanted to get a lawyer after all. But,
well, during the hearings, lawmaker referred to a gimme five system that was set up by Abramoff and his associate Scanlon. Now, what was that again?
A code word for another of these entities, this one being a secret entity. The tribes were not aware that Scanlon and Abramoff were in partnership. Abramoff doing the lobbying, Scanlon doing the political consulting, and in fact, they were working together.
Right. And as the Choctaw Indians discovered, the money they thought was going to promote gambling interests was in fact going to things such as Republican activist Ralph Reed's campaign for lieutenant governor in Georgia. It went to a friend of Abramoff's in Israel who trained snipers. It paid for political junkets. Now, another Republican activist, Grover Norquist, and House Majority Leader Tom DeLay were also mentioned often in Abramoff's correspondences. Is there any sense that either DeLay, Norquist, or Ralph Reed are involved in the scandal?
Well, that wasn't the subject of yesterday's hearing. Certainly, Norquist and Reed were involved in the relationship with the Choctaws, and I don't think anybody's alleged wrongdoing at this point, but there's obviously reason for concern there. Now, Tom DeLay is only peripherally related to this, and this is because of this now famous trip to Scotland he took with Abramoff through yet another nonprofit that Abramoff was affiliated with.
Well, now, Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota read email correspondences between Abramoff and his friend, conservative radio host Rabbi Daniel Lapin, where Abramoff asks for an unusual favor. Can you remind us what that was?
Well, sure. He wanted to get into the Cosmos Club, which is a prestigious lunch and supper club here in town, and he needed some awards. He didn't have any, so he asked the rabbi if he could make some scholar of Talmudic studies, and he'd prefer if the rabbi would predate the award, so it looked like he got it in previous years.
And the rabbi writes back, "What do you need? Letters? Plaques?" What happens next in this case?
One more hearing. This will be on the use of these nonprofit groups, 501c3s, 501c4s. Then they will issue a report. But meantime, the Justice Department is looking at this as well, and that's probably where the real danger to Abramoff and Scanlon is.
Dana Milbank of The Washington Post, thanks for keeping us on top of the story. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And still to come, the music of superstar Juan Luis Guerra. He's on a rare U.S. tour. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here Now mailbag to air some of your thoughts. On Tuesday, a jury found former Ku Klux Klansman Edgar Ray Killen guilty of manslaughter in the 1964 slayings of three civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Earlier that day, we spoke to a former mayor of the town who had testified in Killen's defense. He said he remembers the KKK doing a lot of good. Well, that prompted listener Carol Stanton to write, "I just heard your interview with the former mayor of Philadelphia. It's amazing how ingrained certain attitudes are. I grew up in Florida and taught school in a hotbed of KKK activity. Some of our most outstanding parish members were also Klansmen, and amazingly, they had no dissonance about it." Well, we also took a long look at Detroit last week, a city in an economic freefall. David Wright of Wellesley, Massachusetts, wrote to say he'd married a Detroit native and can answer one of our questions. "What's to love," he writes, "the Detroit Institute of Arts, the fifth largest art collection in the country, Orchestra Hall, a Carnegie-like gem of acoustics and design, the Puebic Pottery, a small factory rooted in the arts and crafts movement, and the Swords into Plowshares Peace Center and Gallery, founded by a Methodist minister, who, yes, just happens to be my father-in-law." Ed Stickney of Billings, Montana, had a question after hearing our interview with filmmaker Morgan Spurlock. In Morgan's documentary, Super Size Me, he ate only McDonald's food for a month to see what the effect would be. Well, Ed writes, "One thing you left out, how much weight did he gain?" The answer, 30 pounds, 10 of them in the first week. And finally, a roundup of your thoughts from around the country after our coverage of the Downing Street memos, the British documents claiming that the Bush administration was intent on war with Iraq a year before war started. We spoke with Todd Purdom of the New York Times, who said in many ways the memos were not that shocking, and Slate writer Eric Boehlert, who disagreed. He said they showed the president lied when telling the public that war was only a last option. Well, we asked your opinion, and boy, do we get it.
Hello, my name is Guy Mendelo. I'm calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. I'm so glad that you asked at the end of your segment whether your guest felt that Bush lied and that your guest had enough courage to say what so many of us know. Yes, of course Bush lied and he misled this country. I'm so glad that someone has the courage to finally use the L word.
Janice Aber from Great Neck, New York, wrote, "The president of the U.S. lying to both the public and to Congress is old news? Please. Todd Purdom is trying to excuse the Times dropping the ball on these memos." Thomas Shaver from Grand Ledge, Michigan, added, "If the possibility exists that this nation was led to war on a lie and 1,700 Americans plus untold thousands of Iraqis are dead as a result, then it's critical that we find the truth." Harold Hopp of Mason City, Iowa, "Our president's lie took us to an indefensible, unnecessary, and insane war. I believe he should be subjected to impeachment." And this from Patrick Karkin of Concord, New Hampshire. "Ever since serving in U.S. Army intelligence prior to the first Gulf War, I've been dismayed by the laziness of the U.S. media regarding Iraq. In 2002, the Bush administration was so insistent on fixing intelligence that they orchestrated the dismissal of U.N. chemical weapons expert Jose Bustani for trying to send inspectors to Iraq. The person who led that charge, none other than John Bolton, Bush's current nominee for ambassador to the UN. Andrea Palmer of Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, "Anyone who was searching the internet long before the war would know that the president was long determined to go to war." Well, we received a lot of letters and phone calls with similar sentiments, but we never heard from anyone who felt that the memos were either old news or not that important. If you're of that opinion, let us know. We'd love to hear from you on this or anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Or call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. One of the biggest attractions worldwide in music is making a rare visit to the United States, the Dominican Republic's Juan Luis Guerra and his group 440.
Tu amor está completamente tierno, forjado de recuerdos. Y sin saber, es cielo en la ventana que me abre la mañana.
The master of merengue with a message, Guerra played to sold-out audiences in New York and Miami, and he's coming to Boston this weekend at the urging of our own Jose Maso. And Jose joins us in the studio to talk more about the music and this long-awaited concert. Hi.
Thank you very much, Robin. It's good to be here.
And you know I also say, it's about time.
Well, 14 years in the making, and I guess it is about time.
Right, because he doesn't need to go anywhere anymore. He's such a big artist. And can you remind us, he's been compared to Paul Simon, Sting, Smokey Robinson. Describe Juan Luis Guerra's appeal.
I think what makes him special is that he was able to break out of his native country of Dominican Republic when he recorded Bachata Rosa. That was back in 1991. It allowed people to hear the magnitude of his repertoire, not only merengue from his native country, but also bachata, which is a beautiful romantic style of bolero, salsa, which we know very well, but also some influences from Africa, some jazz, some big, big, big lush arrangements of mm-hmm. violins, but more than anything, it's his lyrics. He's a poet, Robin. He is really, truly a poet.
And a socially responsible one as well. I'm thinking of the song where everybody raises an umbrella when he sings it. What's that?
Ojalá que llueva café. This wish, this prayer that rain coffee so that everyone can live a good life.
Ojalá que llueva café en el campo, sembrar un alto cerro de trigo y mapue, baja por la colina de arroz craneado y continúa el arado con tu querer. Oh, 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 oh. Ojalá el otoño en vez de hojas.
But his social consciousness is such that he has his own foundation, the Juan Luis Guerra Foundation, and just recently he won a Spirit of Hope Award during the Billboard Magazine Awards in April in Miami. And this is because of the work the foundation does with children who are underprivileged children in receiving medical care. So he is someone who is not only giving throughout his music, but also giving throughout his work in his foundation.
He's got a Boston connection. He attended the Berklee School of Music here in Boston. Mm-hmm. And you can hear that jazz and sophisticated music influence in his songs.
Very much so. He's a graduate of 1982. When he first came to Berklee, it was to study guitar because he was a Pat Metheny wannabe. That's the way he says it. I was Pat Metheny wannabe. I wanted to play that guitar like Wes Montgomery. And then he discovered that he had something else to offer, which was his native music. And he went back and brought to the Dominican Republic what he had learned from Berklee as far as jazz compositions, vocals in particular, the Manhattan Transfer, very influential. And then at the same time, it was here in Boston that he met his future wife, Nora, and the mother of his children. So he has a very strong Boston connection. He loves this city.
Let's listen to a little more of his music. And I know you've got two songs. One demonstrates some of that musicality, that quick change that'll come when you least expect it. And another, the romance.
And they're both romantic in different ways, but I think the first has to do with the lyrics in the sense that it's burbujas amor, love bubbles, in which he wishes he were a fish that he could kiss his loved one through the window pane of the fishbowl. And then the second one, cuando te beso, when I kiss you, which is a very lush arrangement. You feel like you're in a movie theater seeing this great movie. And both are examples of how he is able to compose not only lyrically but musically. The first one, burbujas de amor.
Corazón mutilado de esperanza y de razón. Tengo un corazón que madruga donde quiera. Ay, 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 ese corazón. Todo un océano me corre por las venas. Nacen flores en mi cuerpo cual jardín. Y me abonas y me podas, soy feliz. Y soy
sobre mi lengua se despiste un ruiseñor. Y entre sus alitas nos amamos sin pudor. Cuando me besas, un premio Nobel le regalas a mi boca.
Music of Juan Luis Guerra. You know, Jose, that I'm swooning. I love this music. And I'll name drop a little bit now. I was once at a party in Spanish Harlem, Maria Hinojosa's house, and she was playing all this wonderful music. And I said, "Do you have Juan Luis Guerra?" And she said, "Oh, he's on the roof." And he happened to be visiting. And he's shy. I mean, very reclusive. And we understand recently became a born-again Christian.
Yes, a born-again Christian. And it's influenced his music as of late. In ways that his latest CD, Para Ti, which caught a lot of people by surprise because they didn't expect the CD to do well, but it has done very well with the lyrics that speak about his faith and his Christianity. The selection that I'd like to share with you is one that many people have identified with and has become one of probably the theme of the CD. It's titled Tan Solo He Venido. I've only come for this.
Solo quiero escucharte. Pon el tema, Señor. Caminar por el parque y dedicarte una canción. Tan solo he venido a estar contigo, a ser tu amigo, compartir con mi Dios, adorarte.
Robin, this selection is one that when he performs it live, people actually cry. I mean, they sit there, hold hands, look at each other and start crying because of the profundity of, you know, so profound the message that he has. And it's one that I really look forward to hearing him perform live.
Can you share with us just a few of the words of the song?
It's one in which he's actually praying. And he's praying to God, saying, "I've come to ask this, but I already know the answer because you've given me the answer before I've even asked it." And it sounds like a prayer, really. You know, it sounds like a real smooth way of praying to God.
The beautiful music of Juan Luis Guerra. How exciting is it for, I mean, he's a huge superstar around the world, but Jose Maso, how exciting is it for Dominicans when he comes to the U.S.?
Well, you know, these days, I think the two things that most speak about Dominican pride here in the United States is baseball. Mm-hmm. And you can talk about Manny, and you can talk about David Ortiz or
Manny
Pedro
Ramirez,
Martinez.
David Ortiz,
exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Or music. And the ambassador and the icon for this type of music is Juan Luis Guerra. So it's a national pride. You will see the flags, but you also see other countries represented, from Puerto Rico to Venezuela and Colombia, where he is very popular, and Spain as well. So he is an icon. He is truly a superstar, and everything that represents the most positive of the Dominican Republic.
Here now is Jose Maso on Dominican superstar Juan Luis Guerra, who's making a special appearance here in Boston this weekend at a concert hosted and arranged by Jose. And we have to add, you're both celebrating Guerra's group 440 turns 20, and your radio show Con Salsa, which is heard here in Boston, turns 30 years old. Felicitaciones.
Gracias. You said it right.
Felicidades,
yes.
Mi amigo.
Muchas gracias, Robin.
And for more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.